All right. Thanks for inviting me here. Let's see if I can get everything working. All right. You have to ask me about that picture later. It's a really cool story, but I'm not going to tell you. All right. So, I'm going to talk about our experiments where we see evidence for many body localization. And I'm not going to do a lot of introduction to the topic. You know, my group for a long time has been motivated by experiments on solids and condensed matter theory to look at, in various scenarios corresponding to experiments in the solid state, trying to answer this question, what's the fate of interacting disordered quantum particles? And I don't have to tell this crowd how there's all kinds of interesting real-life problems where this is relevant. Okay, so we've worked on this problem from many different angles. We use real disorder in our experiments. We work with disordered bosons. We've seen, for example, superfluid to Bose-Glass transition. We've also been able to do a Bose-Glass to superfluid quench and work out what happens there. And we also work with disordered fermions, the same fermion that we just talked about, potassium 40, where we're able to see 3D Anderson localization in free space and evidence for MBL. And so today what I'll focus on mostly is this evidence for MBL and looking basically in transport measurements. Okay, and that's the reference, and I'll put this back up later in the talk too. Okay, so an outline, I'm going to do a little bit of introduction, and sprinkled throughout the talk I'm going to explain how we actually do the experiments. I'll talk about how we make disordered 3D optical lattices and try to give you an idea of how to think about it. And I'll talk about the transport measurements, which give us evidence for MBL. And then I will spend some time at the end telling you about what we want to do next. And this is really motivated by conversations with many of you, like Vadim and Dimitri and many other people. And where we're heading now is to do spatially local excitations and look at relaxation, both spin and charge. Okay, so how do we make quantum gases? We said a little bit about this. The experiments are complicated. There's lots of lasers. It all happens in a vacuum system. And down here, we make ultra-cold Fermi gases of these potassium 40 atoms. There's a lot of lasers. We trap the atoms with laser beams. And ultimately, what we do is we make this Fermi gas, and we work at temperatures where T over T Fermi is about 0.15 or higher. And I'll show you measurements in this talk where we increase the temperature. And the way we take data for most of the talk today is we measure momentum or quasi-momentum profiles. So we have these atoms in a trap. We do something to them, trap in a lattice. We turn all the lattice and trap potentials off and the disorder potential off. We let the atoms expand for about 20 milliseconds. And we shine a beam of resonant light down this part of the vacuum system here, this tube. Oh, and just for scale, that's 1 inch distance between those holes. And the atoms cast a shadow into that laser beam, and we image that shadow into a CCD camera. And because we have them expand for a while, this really becomes a momentum profile, or really a crystal momentum profile. So when I show you these pictures through most of this talk, you should think of the axes really being quasi-momentum in the x and y directions, or crystal momentum. Okay, so that's how we take most of the data I'll show you today. All right, so in our experiments, how do we add disorder? We start with this gas that's trapped. The trap and the lattice on its own is really very perfect. And so, of course, the way we add disorder, the way we do anything in these experiments, is we add another laser beam. So in our apparatus, we shine a laser beam down from the top here. It's a green laser beam. It's about the color of this laser pointer. And we focus it through a very high numerical aperture lens that has a holographic diffuser glued to the bottom of it. Now, that holographic diffuser is a very proprietary device. It's very hard to find out much about it. Here's one of them. It actually looks like a dirty piece of plastic. It's just a very highly engineered piece of plastic that no one will tell you anything about. But the company who makes them, primarily for projectors, is very nice, and they would just send us sheets of this stuff, and that's how we make disorders. So we shine a laser beam through it, and if you look up there, you can see up at the top of the projector, that's an optical speckle field. That's what the light does when it comes down to the focal plane here. So you can see it looks like a disordered light field with lots of bright and dark regions. And what's great in these experiments is we can measure that disorder really exactly, because we can put a scanning microscope there and measure the full 3D intensity profile. And there it is. That's what the disorder looks like. And the atoms feel potential energy proportional to the light intensity. So the atoms experience a potential landscape, which is disorder. We can control the amount of disorder, the variation in that potential landscape, by just changing the laser power. So we can have it be absent, or we can have it be, actually in our case, stronger than any other energy scale if we wish. OK, so how do we make a disordered Hubbard model, which is really what we study? So we have our disorder, and we also add a 3D cubic optical lattice. Oh, well, first let me say we trap atoms in two spin states in this system. You can think of them as spin up and spin down. In these experiments I'll tell you about today, there's always equal numbers of the spin up and spin down atoms, and that's conserved. There's no spin changing collisions on any relevant time scale here. So the other thing we do is we add this 3D cubic optical lattice. So we have pairs of laser beams in three orthogonal directions. And that makes the particles very strongly interacting. So there's a lattice potential that's really perfect from those laser beams, and it's cubic. I'm just showing you a cross section of it here. We can control the height of that lattice potential by just controlling the power in these red laser beams, and that allows us to vary the ratio of the Hubbard interaction to tunneling energy. The disorder potential adds to that independently, and that strength of that can be controlled independently from the tunneling and interaction strength. And those two potentials add to produce a disordered lattice. And this is basically data. This is what the disordered lattice looks like. And the atoms sort of find themselves in this disordered lattice potential. One thing, Rachel had this question, what's a disorder length scale? Actually, the disorder correlation length is about equal to a lattice spacing or so. OK, so it's pretty fine-grained disorder. And this exactly realizes a disordered Hubbard model. So let me tell you a little bit about that. So if you're not familiar with these experiments, and I don't know how many of you have heard a version of this talk before, but there's some people here I don't know, so that probably means there's some of you who may not be super familiar with this. Here's a picture you should have in your head. In our experiment, we have this optical lattice potential. That's like the potential, the Coulomb potential from the ionically or covalently bonded crystal in a solid. Our atoms in this potential are like the electrons, so that's the correspondence you should have. Okay, so the Hubbard model, of course, is a sort of minimal model for strongly correlated materials. It's got this interaction and tunneling term. And I don't have to tell most of you here that what those two terms are. For us, the atoms in this lattice, in the clean lattice, they can do exactly the same thing. Atoms can tunnel from site to site. And if two atoms are on the same site in opposite states of spin, they can interact with each other with some energy U. All right, so we've got a tunneling energy and an interaction energy U. And we control the ratio of these things by just changing this lattice potential depth by increasing the power in these laser beams. So if we make the power very high, we make this lattice potential very deep, then the tunneling energy small and the interaction energy grows, and so U over T grows. And we can tune that ratio over many orders of magnitude. All right, and here are some of the energy scales here. We use kind of a funny energy unit called the recoil energy, which is KB times about 390 nanokelvin. The lattice spacing is 400 nanometers. Okay, but we can access U over T, you know, of 1 to 100. And that's what controls all the physics. Okay, so that was the clean system. The great thing here is because we know everything about the disorder, we actually know everything about the disordered Hubbard model that we actually realize. So for us, we end up with disorder in every Hubbard parameter. All right, so the tunneling energies become disordered, and that's because the disorder is very fine-grained. The interaction energies are disordered a little bit, again, because the disorder is actually very fine-grained. And of course, normally we just neglect this term, the sort of on-site occupation energy, but those are very disordered as well, so we have to keep track of that. And so we got together with David Separately's group years ago and figured out, we found all the single particle eigenfunctions, or they did. We didn't do anything except say, hey, this is a great idea. And here are the distributions of Hubbard parameters, the statistical distributions from some typical case. You can see the distribution of occupation energies is kind of one-sided. The tunneling energies, they can't go negative in this case. It's kind of Lorentzian and a little skewed. And if you look at the sort of variation in the interaction energies compared to the mean value or the value without the lattice, it's very small, but it's there. Okay, and that disorder energy delta, it turns out it's almost exactly equal to about within 10% of the distribution of the diagonal disorder, the standard deviation of that distribution. So, you know, it's a physical parameter we control with the laser beam, and the way we measure it has some meaning in that sense, but you can also think about when we disorder the system and increase delta, it makes the standard deviation get broader. And it's also linked to the standard deviation of these other distributions as well. Okay, so that's exactly the Hubbard model we realize. There you go. One thing I would just want to point out briefly, and this has been discussed a bit, I think it's important to point out the differences between what we do and what happens in an electronic solid. And I do this because I remember I was at a Gordon conference where I gave a talk a couple years ago, and Peter Armitage and I just spent about a day talking, and we didn't make sense to each other at all, so we just talked and talked, and neither one of us understood what the other one was saying. And I realized this inspired me to sit down and think, well, what are the real differences here, and why is some of the intuition you may have from solids different? So first off, remember, there are no phonons in this lattice. That means there's no variable range hopping, right? Very important. There's no heat bath. It's on the time scales we measure, it's a very closed quantum system, so there's no cryostat here. A key thing is that the coherence length is much larger than the system size, and the scattering from the disorder is purely elastic. So you're used to, in solids, thinking about electron coherence length, and that plays a really important role in how you calculate things. Here, the analog of that is enormous. It's the system size. And there's a trap, which is important too, so we have an inhomogeneous density profile, and that means that the momentum profile of a very cold Fermi gas is not sharp because of the trap, so there's no sharp Fermi integer momentum. What's that?
What do you mean by greater?
Oh, just the sense that the single particle eigenstates are totally devocalized. Because there's not interacting with a bath. You know, like in a solid, you would think about little wave packets for electrons with some coherence length. Yeah, I'm just talking about the single particle problem, neglecting the interactions. Because in a solid, if you put one electron in there, it would scatter off the phonons, and you know that's quite important understanding what happens. So I think that difference is important to keep in mind. You probably appreciate that, but my experience is not everybody else does. Yeah?
There's coherence length, but there's also coherence time.
Yeah.
So coherence time here presumably is not so great because your systems are slow and the electromagnetic noise from the rest of the universe somehow manages to penetrate, or is there a similar statement of coherence time?
Coherence time is also very long. So for the kind of single particle, if I put one particle in the disordered lattice, the coherence time is very, very long. The interacting problem is different.
But even in the non-attractive problem, you're saying there's no continuous spectral drift of all the levels?
No.
The elevators go up and down?
No, because we work hard to make that all go away.
All right.
Yeah. That's I'm glad you asked that question, Vadim, because that's also really important thing to keep in mind when you try to understand what's happening here. So thank you for that question. Okay, so these are some differences to keep in mind. All right, so what I want to talk about today are measurements on what we would think of traditionally in condensed matter physics as the dirty metal in the system. Okay, so first let me kind of orient you to what we're doing and how you should think about it in the non-interacting case. Okay, so kind of the Anderson limit. So our system is very much a single band system. All right, so I drew this as a 1D band, but really it's a three-dimensional band with a bandwidth that's 12T. And what we do in the experiments I'm about to tell you about is we tune the particle number confinement to put the Fermi energy right in the middle of the band, kind of 6T. Okay? So when I sorry, this is left in here from a colloquium, so you should kind of think of it like something like copper. And you can see in our system, here's one of these images. Here's the Brillouin zone. The Brillouin zone is, of course, a cube, but we image it along a funny direction, so it looks like a hexagon. All right. So here's a very cold Fermi gas, and you can basically see the Fermi surface here, and it's well within the Brillouin zone, so you would think of this normally as a metal. Okay, so what happens when you add disorder? Well, there are mobility edges, again, in the single particle system. Very well understood, there are mobility edges that close the band from the top and bottom of the band. So if you just ask what would happen here as I turn up disorder in the non-interacting case, states at the big top and the bottom of the band would start to become localized. There's some mobility edges. Really, I should say there's a top and bottom one. And eventually, for sufficient disorder, the whole band will become localized. Okay, so for the non-interacting problem, what would happen is once this mobility edge reached the Fermi energy, whatever disorder that took, we'll call that some characteristic amount of disorder, the system would turn from a metal into an insulator because all the single particle states are localized. Okay, so that's just the intuition from the non-interacting problem. So the measurements I'm going to tell you about today is in the interacting problem, how do things affect this characteristic amount of disorder required to localize the system? That's what we're going to try to look at, is look at this metal insulator transition and see what happens to this delta C as we vary things like temperature or interaction strength. Now, the fantastic thing is the single particle mobility edge is now known for our disorder. Okay, this is great. I've been waiting for this to happen for a long time. Sebastiano Pilati, I met up with him this summer at DAMOP, and he's like, I think we can calculate this. And I said, I hope you can calculate this. This would be great. So here's a single particle mobility edge plotted versus disorder. Okay, so you can see there's some amount of disorder. Here it's scaled by the tunneling energy, which makes this sort of universal without interactions. And it takes some amount of disorder, and the total band out here is localized. for disorders greater than, oh, I don't know, 11 times the tunneling energy. Okay, and one thing I'll say is, I'm not going to tell you how we make these measurements yet, but I just want to tell you, because many of you have seen this talk before. In fact, we've never published data for the Anderson problem without interactions, but we have it. And where we see localization occurs is really coincident very well with this amount of disorder. And that's true for the weakest interaction strength, I'll tell you as well. Okay, so it's kind of interesting, and it sort of shows you how things hang together in the system. Yeah? It's 3D. So he calculated the 3D mobility edge. He did actually the continuous model. It's awesome. Yeah. So it's not this isn't the discrete model. This is a real continuum model. And for our disorder, actually, it's really exciting. Yes, Rahul. So there must be some states. So I need to ask Sebastian, I don't know about this, but there must be some states that are generated outside the original band by the disorder. This is true, actually. We know this from work with Sepperly's group. Yeah. But what's good is just, yeah, you know, what happens, taking into account all the disorder, and this is a real space calculation, is the band becomes localized.
So in the continuous model, you shouldn't have a fully localized regime. So presumably, did you misspeak? It's a lattice model with spectral disorder?
It is, yeah.
This is in the lowest band. There's
yeah.
Spaced up much higher.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, there's, right. This is in the lowest band.
There's other bands up higher.
Right. Right. There's other bands, yes, absolutely. We're just not energetically accessible in our experiment. Okay, so this is useful to us, and this will help guide intuition in conjunction with this sort of non-interacting picture. Okay, so moving along. Yeah, okay. The higher energy bands are interesting, and thinking about how much population is up there is important, although when we measure, we don't see any population that we can measure in the higher bands. Okay, so again, this crowd, I don't really have to tell you much about MBL or the BAA paper. So, you know, what was interesting to us is that in the BAA paper, you know, you can just ask, so it sort of tried to answer the question, what happens to the simple non-interacting picture when there are interactions, okay? And so we all know that it's possible to have MBL, and that's maybe difficult or impossible to test in solids because of variable range hopping, which we don't have here. So this is a great system to try to test some of these predictions that you can have a perfect insulator across some range of temperature in the regime where all the single particle states are localized. Okay, so we're going to go look for this and see what we see. All right, so the BA paper translated to our system makes basically three predictions that we can try to probe, that we can see. One is that localization is possible at non-zero temperature, that there's interaction-induced delocalization, and there's localization across a range of temperatures. Okay, so in fact, we're gonna look for all of these, and we've seen all of these predicted behaviors. So let me tell you how we do that now. We do that through transport measurements. So here's my version of a transport measurement in a solid, right? You hook something up to a power supply, you set some voltage, there's some current, and then you use Ohm's law to get the resistivity, and you don't touch this because things aren't grounded here, so be careful. All right, so how do we do an analog of that in our experiments? So we do something kind of simple that we first pioneered to do experiments. Well, many people have done measurements like this, but we started doing it in this very specific way in order to be able to see a superfluid to Bose-glass transition with bosons. All right, so we have this is not really to scale. There's maybe about 50 lattice sites across the gas, but there's a gas and a lattice and a trap. What we do is we apply a force, which is like your electric field, for some amount of time, and then we turn it off. And of course, in a classical physics tells you there's a momentum impulse theorem, so it develops some velocity or some momentum after the impulse. And what we do is we measure that velocity right after the impulse. So you can kind of think of this as it's kind of a measurement of the low frequency conductivity. And we just make a very simple distinction that if we don't see the gas move, if it does not acquire velocity or momentum, after we apply a force for a short period of time, then it's an insulator. And if we see it move, it's not an insulator. And we're not going to try to interpret this too much because that's complicated. No one really knows how to do it yet. All right, so we're just going to try to distinguish between the case insulator, non-insulator. Okay, the other thing that's really important in these systems is to keep in mind that it's not, and for this kind of measurement, it's not just the particles near the Fermi energy that participate in transport. It's all the particles. So if we have some quasi-momentum distribution in the band, and again, it's not sharp even at zero temperature because of the trap, then we apply a force, they all move, they all respond. And so it's not possible to see something sharp in this measurement because of this.
Is there
What's that?
You can always think of that displacement as just changing your
Yeah, but.
And you should.
Should what? Okay.
Yeah, but it doesn't have translation with variant.
Yeah, you could. Let me show you some pictures and you'll see why I think it's more. I think it's right. I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know what you're. I know what you're saying. But for me, I think it's useful. Let me show you some pictures because I think I want to just talk about it in this way because the pictures are easier to understand in this way. And what you're saying is absolutely true. Yeah, of course you can think about it like that. Okay, so here we have data I'm going to show you for a fixed lattice potential depth, which means U is fixed to 4T, so it's pretty strongly interacting. We can't really access in these measurements the very weakly interacting case. And so here's a picture. Remember, the axis here is crystal momentum. This is for no disorder. Let me just show you what happens first in pictures, okay? This is for no disorder. We apply a force, actually, in this direction. And if we measure what happens afterwards, you can see there's lots of motion, okay? So many particles, not really a linear response type measurement. Many particles acquire momentum, okay, and the whole distribution shifts, all right? And what's happened here is complicated because there's a lot of motion, but they move. Okay, for very large amounts of disorder, if we do the same measurement, okay, what's interesting here, which I never talk about much, is that the quasi-momentum distribution doesn't really change. We apply a force, there's no overall response of the atoms. Okay, so here you're seeing something which you might call a metal, and here, something which is almost certainly an insulator because it simply doesn't respond to forces. So what I can do now is, instead of pictures, I can show you quantitative data where we take pictures like this and we figure out the amount of center of mass, velocity, or momentum. Here we do everything of velocity, but you can think about it as momentum after the force. And so you can see this picture is without disorder. There's lots of motion. And this picture is out here, a very large disorder. There's no motion anymore. Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, which let's talk about that later. I mean, it's not that the disorder is, the disorder here is, yeah.
These are just pictures of an expanding class.
Right, I mean, you have to be careful now how you, I think this is a really interesting question. So, yeah, you know, why it looks like this in the interacting case, I don't think anybody really totally understands this, okay?
Cross section of that, there's no sharp Fermi surface. It's probably just a Gaussian proxy.
Well, there, it always is. There's no sharp Fermi surface ever because of the trap.
Right. If you fit that guy, it probably looks Boltzmann, right?
No, it looks Fermi. You have to remember in these systems because of the trap, there's never a sharp Fermi surface ever.
Right.
Yeah. Even at t equals zero.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
What's that? Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about. So Ehud, your question is really great, and I want to talk more about this. And this is because there are very deep questions here about what actually happens. Oh, yeah. No, thank you. We don't need to update Java. There are really deep questions here about what happens when we turn on the lattice, whether we reach an equilibrium state or not. Okay. My guess is probably no, especially in the case where things are very localized. All right. And so that might be really important to these pictures and what's happening. What's that?
What is it, red? Why is red gone on the right-hand side?
Don't worry about it. This is a false color scaling, and we were not very careful here about scaling. These are just, we didn't do any number correction here.
Doesn't mean that. No, don't worry about it.
No, this is just, we wanted to be totally straightforward, so we didn't rescale this image so it had the same atom number as this image.
It has the same atom.
Yeah. Or within, well, no, because there's always atom number variation, but, you know, it's within the shot-to-shot atom number. Betting.
The
questions aren't stupid. And I wanted to give a talk like this because these questions, I think, are hugely valuable to me.
Why do we see a hexagonal?
The Brillouin zone's a cube, but we image it along a weird direction. Oh. And so it looks like a hexagon projected onto the imaging plane. That's it. Okay? Yeah. Yes?
So how do you prepare your
So what we do is the standard thing everybody does is we cool a gas, spin mixed gas in a trap, okay, and then we slowly turn on the disordered lattice. Now, there are great questions, and we've written papers on this, as to whether or not the system's in equilibrium. Okay, almost certainly it's not in equilibrium. The question is how far from equilibrium is it?
Do you operate in the adiabatic region where you expect it to have
Yeah, I mean, you know,
it's not at zero temperature.
Right. It's also not at zero temperature, right? The lowest temperature here is a tenth of the Fermi temperature.
Yeah, well, you're not mentioning that it's...
No. Everything is turned on slowly. So we try to adiabatically load as best we can into the disordered lattice. But when the system is localized, when all the single particle states are localized, how does this work? Nobody knows the answer to this, actually. Something happens, and that's okay. You know, what's good is we know what the distribution is in the states such as they are, and we can ask whether they respond to a force or not. But understanding this loading process is a really interesting question. And we know a little bit now about whether the system's in equilibrium or not, but that's a whole other talk. Okay, let me move on a little bit to tell you more about what's happening here, okay, because I want to tell you some new things we're doing too at the end. Okay, so that's a basic observation. Is there something from that looks like a metal to something that looks like an insulator as we turn up the disorder at some fixed interaction strength? And so what we can do is one way or another try to estimate the amount of characteristic disorder required to make the system localize. Okay? And we did this here by a fit. And then we ask where the fit intersects our uncertainty band with zero. We can do this in many different ways, and we basically always get the same answer. All right, so we have some measure of how much disorder is required to get this to the limit where we can't see it move. And for this case, it's very, very close to where the single particle mobility edge closes the band, actually. Okay, so that's a good sanity check. All right. And let me just say, this is a very good measurement, actually, so the students worked really hard. This uncertainty band and velocity is really tiny, so they worked really hard to make this a very excellent measure of when this reaches zero within as well as we can resolve it. Okay, so what we're going to do now is look at how this changes with various things, or what happens to this characteristic disorder. And if you want to get some intuition for this, just this is like the version of the single particle problem when the band becomes fully localized. Okay, so a simple thing we can do is just do this measurement. At different lattice potential depths, which means different values of u over t. So we can repeat this measurement, increasing the lattice potential depth for higher and higher lattice potential depths, which means higher and higher u over t, and look at how this characteristic amount of disorder changes by fitting these all to some kind of function or using some heuristic to estimate where it crosses the uncertainty band around zero. Okay, so just remember, when we do this, we're just making u over t larger and larger and larger. Okay, so here are the reduced data. Here's that characteristic disorder strength divided by 12t that we found. And this is u over 12t, which is just changed by changing the lattice potential depth. And we normalize this to 12t, because in the non-interacting picture, this should just not change along the lattice potential depth axis if the u was 0. This should just be a fixed number if I normalize by 12t, because it's the only energy scale in the non-interacting problem. And so you can see that when we turn up the disorder strength, it requires more and more disorder to localize the gas, and therefore there's an insulator metal transition that's mediated by interactions. Okay, and the slope of this line is really positive at 99 point something confidence interval. Okay, so there's this insulator metal transition, this delocalization transition that comes from interactions. Yeah?
Did you increase the iteration
protocol? Well, so this regime is a regime we have to be, you know, so this is the metallic regime. Right, so if we go out here, we go close out here somewhere, then we'll form a mod insulator in the middle of the gas.
Okay, so the density is around density 1.
Oh yeah, right, EF is like 6T. Okay, so EF is 6T, so this means there's you know,
yeah.
Right, in the middle of the trap, the density is around 1.
So you can't see the reactor behavior or anything?
No, well, I have ideas about this by pushing the density down and trying to play around with this. But in any case, the goal here was to try to probe the nominally metallic, the putatively metallic regime of the Hubbard model. Whatever this metal is weird. If we go much lower than this, the lattice type binding doesn't become very good, so we should not go over here because that gets complicated. If we go up here, we can start to get a mod insulator, and we want to be careful because, you know, there's some uncertainty in the tunneling energy and the lattice depth calibration. We want to be careful just to probe this regime. That's all. Yeah, David.
Does the sign of U matter?
We cannot change the sign of U right now. We will be able to do so shortly, and then that would be really interesting.
Can you polarize your gas?
Yeah. I have those data. Let's talk about that later.
It doesn't look the same.
It doesn't look the same, no. We've never published this data. There's a problem in interpreting those data because the gas cannot thermalize when you turn the lattice on, so then you know it's way out of equilibrium. So making sure the energy distribution is constant, which you kind of want to do, is hard.
What does
What's that? Oh, yeah, so there's a classical percolation transition, which is not this. So we can do this simple calculation, just energetic percolation, right? So you just look in a lattice, when do you go? So it's like in a cubic lattice, it's 0.3, right? You need to break a third of the bonds. And we just ask, when does classical percolation happen? Because sites become energetically inaccessible. Okay, so that's just, there'd be classical, right? There's a classical percolation threshold where the particles cannot percolate across the lattice. No, this is just, if I remember right, and this is from a long time ago, that's just, let's find out. I will find out for you. I have to go read my student's thesis because this is a while ago. This is actually data we took, 2 years ago now, so I'll find out for you, Rahul. Okay, let me keep going a little bit. The other thing we can do here is we can vary the energy density by varying the temperature before we turn on the lattice. So what we can do is we can make the atmospheric cold by cooling the gas a lot before we turn the lattice. Or we could not cool them as much, so they're hotter, and turn on the lattice, and then see what happens. All right, so we can vary the energy density this way by changing the temperature of the gas before we turn on the lattice and do this kind of measurement. So here's, what we do is, this basically sets the entropy per particle, the T over TF, which sets the energy density in the disordered lattice. Okay, so what we can do now is what we're going to do is go right to this case where the gas is just localized and turn the temperature up and see what happens. And so here's what happens in pictures. So we apply, so this is the coldest data, all right? This is lowest temperature. We go right to this disorder. We turn on the force. The gas does not move. So it's localized. That's what we saw before. We make it a little hotter. Apply a force. Doesn't move. Make it a little hotter still. Apply a force. Doesn't move. And it's not like this is super high temperature. This temperature here, the hottest temperatures, our estimate of it is about twice the tunneling energy. Okay, so it's not crazy hot. It's just cold and less cold. Okay. And so here, so what we can do now is measure the response of the system at versus temperature. And so that's what this is. This is a very expanded axis here. So remember, this is 50 microns per second. This is a tiny velocity. And so what we see is across the range of temperatures we sample, and this is temperature measured, estimated in some way. Really, you should think about this as energy density. The motion of the gas is really very consistent with zero. Okay, so it looks like the gas remains insulating across a range of energy densities. And there's a limited range of energy densities we can probe. We don't want to fill the band too much, because if we just fill the band too much through temperature, it would just be an insulator anyway, and we wouldn't see any motion in this measure. So we purposefully sampled the range of temperature here, where without the disorder, we'd always be able to see some motion. And with the disorder, no motion seems to occur. OK. So all these predictions from the BAA paper are basically things we observe in the experiment: localization on zero temperature, interaction-induced delocalization, and delocalization or localization across a range of temperatures. If there's a critical temperature for the system to not be an insulator anymore, we can't see it, and I think it's probably just at a temperature we can't really access where there'd be other confounding problems that we would be hard to separate. Yeah, we can do them with a spin-polarized gas. So if you want to talk about, we have those data. It's just interpreting them is yet more difficult, because the gas cannot thermalize when you turn the lattice on. So what the gas is doing in the lattice is a little hard to understand. Now, this is a long discussion, and we could have this not during the talk.
Well, of course, what I'm wondering is, do you see the effect of particles stemming inside?
Well, so this system, these data are taken where the single particle mobility edge is closed. Okay, so we would have, we also have data taken at less disorder where the mobility edge is not closed. We actually don't see much happen there either, interestingly. Yeah.
If you don't mind, so very quick question. So the gas cannot thermalize when it's been polarized because
the particles can't collide with each other.
Can't interact.
Right.
It's not a TJ model at J equals zero. It's really not attractive because you.
Yeah.
That's bizarre. Okay.
It's a bizarre thing. We actually now have some understanding of what the gas does in the lattice without the disorder for the non-interacting case. But that's a long, long discussion. So what I want to do now is just close with a few slides telling you about a few things that have happened recently and things we want to do after this transport measurement, because there's a lot more things to learn here. One thing I just want to mention is there's a theory development. So Vito Scarola has done kind of a mean field theory of this problem. And the kind of theory he did works only at high disorder strengths and for the spin balance gas. And this is all with the spin balance gas. And high interaction strength, spin balance, high disorder. So what he did is he did a simulation that's kind of a mean field simulation with no free parameters. He matched everything from the experiment. And he sees basically the same things we see in our experiment for, you know, a limited case he can explore. All right. And the interpretation from this is one way to think about what's happening at high interaction strength here is this kind of AL of Hubbard quasi particles. So I'm not particularly qualified to talk much about this result, but I encourage you to check out this archive paper to see what Vito was able to calculate. So it's a recent theory development in relationship to these transport measures. He just numerically does the same experiment we do in a mean field type of regime. Okay, so now what are we setting up to do now? So let me just throw a bunch of stuff out there and tell you kind of what we're up to. What we're kind of interested in is local relaxation dynamics. So for example, and this again was inspired by many conversations with many of you. We had set out to do something a little bit different, but then many of you convinced me we should do something else. So what we're gonna do, one thing we're doing right now in the lab is making a hole in the gas. All right, so we can take a laser beam, it makes a repulsive Gaussian potential, and focus it really tightly in the gas, and make a spot size, actually it's more about 2 microns than a way you might be used to measuring it. And what we can see is we can make a really nice hole in the gas. Okay, so it's there's an example where we've poked a hole in the gas with this repulsive focused beam at low power. And remember, and now this image is an image taken in the trap. So this is not momentum anymore. This is an image in real space. And our imaging resolution is about equal to 3 lattice sites. So we can pretty well spatially resolve things in the system. So you poke a hole through the gas, take an image while it's still in the lattice, and that's what we see. We see a hole. And at high power, we take this Gaussian and make it much, much bigger than all the energy scales present, and we get really sharp walls. So we can make a really sharp wall, cylindrical barrier inside the gas. And so what we're interested in doing now is a whole bunch of things, like watching the dynamics of the hole filling. So this is a little movie of what happens when we put this barrier in, we make a huge hole, and then we take it away. Don't get too excited. This is a thermal gas in a thermal Bose gas just in a trap, but we did this to make sure, you know, it behaves reasonably, and we can use some kind of Boltzmann description to understand it. But you can see what happens is the hole fills in, okay, and it takes some amount of time, and in this case, it's just driven by interactions. You can understand it from a Boltzmann picture. So I think it'd be really fun to do this kind of measurement, but in, you know, in a lattice with fermions between a sort of metallic and insulating state, and just see, can we measure a diffusion constant this way? What can we see happen? How can we understand this hole? Will it just not close in the case where the system looks like it's localized through transport? So how do we see this, and how does it correspond? Yes, and also, you know, this idea of making a local, you know, we can also make the potential attractive, so locally pull down a few sites, and then we could measure the time dynamics of how the density distribution responds, much like we heard yesterday, and look to see if we see anything like the predictions of what should happen in an MBL phase versus other kinds of phases. So I think that's exciting. We're set up to do this now. Actually, for us, it's also pretty easy, and we basically are set up to do this as well, I don't have data to show you, to look at making a spin excitation. So for example, in the lattice, what we could do is we can join in another laser beam with this one laser beam and drive Raman transitions between spin states. But because they're co-propagating, this doesn't impart any momentum to the atoms. So for example, we could do something like make a spin polarized gas, make a spin excitation that's localized, so flip the spins in the center of the gas, and then watch them diffuse or not diffuse as we wait, watching in real space. So this comes back to the idea that Vadim was thinking about is, could we look at spin diffusion, and what would it look like? When we see in transport, it looks like the charge is localized. Will it look like the spin is localized or not? So that would be fun to do too. So we see MBL in that measure. And the last thing we can do is kind of a local Ramsey or spectroscopy experiment, where we can make a sort of local pi halves pulse, so flip all the spins into the plane, wait some time, and then do a global, a spatially uniform second pi halves pulse and read out where's all that, what's happened to that initial spin superposition, and what would we see in that case. So those are all things we're setting up to do. We're basically set up to do them now, and we'll be doing those over the next year or two. Lastly, I do know how to do 2D localization with real disorder. We have a kind of proposal where we did numerics. It's published in this paper. We know how to do point-like disorder in 2D. We can avoid classical trapping completely. We know how to do that. We also know how to generate observable localization lengths in the non-interacting limit. So we numerically simulated that. So actually, I've renovated lab space. And if you know anybody who wins a lottery, let me know if they want to, you know, make a charitable donation to physics. We just need the equipment money now to build the experiment. All right. So if you need to reduce your tax burden, let me know. All right. And we do a lot of other stuff. Here's a bunch of other papers and quantum quenches we work on as well. And there's my group. That's everyone who actually did all the work. Thanks.
Since you've done all this work on single particle localization in 3D, I was wondering, for the specific speckle potential, the disorder is peculiar at low energies because it's square of a complex field. Is that right? So you have these nodal lines?
Yeah, speckle's pretty strange. Yeah. There's lots of weird things about it.
You might not see it for generic energies, but when you go to low energies in some semi-classical sense, there are these percolate, and they percolate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so the question
they
is,
fully percolate. Yeah, those don't align.
Yeah. So, is
there there's also optical vortex rings that can trap, but that's a crazy low energy scale.
This is a short question.
Yeah. Okay.
can you actually, rather than focusing on generic aspects of your disordered lattices, can you actually go to, and even in the single particle, can you actually see the signs of these sort of peculiar?
So we never see this, and one of the things we looked at, why not? We looked, as far as we can tell, the atoms don't seem to know much about this. So we looked separately at things carefully, like there are correlations in the Hubbard parameters, and this paper was separately, and there's a PRB that followed it without my name on it, which looked at some of this. And some of that gets into the correlation of Hubbard parameters, right? So like, there are correlations between the difference in site energies between neighboring sites and the tunneling energy between them. Not totally simple ones. They're kind of weak, and that's where some of that stuff appears. But in the experiments, we've never really seen a sign of it. So, yeah.
Coming back to this momentum distributions that you showed after applying the force.
Yeah.
So, I guess kind of the point that you don't see the Prion zone spreading out completely without the force in the case of strong disorder means that you have to find a correlation length of the disorder, right? That's why your atom is not localized to a single letter site, to like say something like two neighboring letter sites.
Yeah.
That's why you get this cutoff here in the momentum.
Yeah, so you can guesstimate from this picture. You can put a lower bound on localization length, right? So you can ask, if you had a particle localized to some number of sites, what would the quasi-momentum distribution of that particle look like, right? So you can calculate that. And so what you can do is you can put a lower bound on the localization length, because if it got too small, it would spread out over the whole Brillouin zone. So that lower cutoff is about two lattice. But it could be long, the localization length could be longer than that.
So that's the correlation length then of your disorder that sets this bound, or?
I have no idea. Right, I mean, the correlation length of the disorder is about a lattice, about a lattice spacing.
Okay. And now for the real question.
Yeah.
If you do this, if you do the apply the force at delta equals zero, you scatter particles into high momenta. But why don't you do that when delta is large? Do you have any intuitive idea why?
Why this can't happen? Because these particles are localized, right?
Yeah. No, well,
these are just, you can generate this distribution by just doing semi-classics. So here you just take a bunch of particles with block wave functions,
mm-hmm.
and you just propagate Newton's equation, and you'll get this. That's it.
Yeah, but with the disorder, of course, the momentum distribution can only broaden, it cannot shrink. So if you broaden it and then you displace it, why does it not have the same width, at least, than in the clean case?
So is your question why we don't see any response here?
Yeah. Why is it not broader?
Why is it broader?
Why is it not broader? Why should it should be broader, right?
Well, what will happen if the particles are really localized, right, what will happen in the solid state community, they talk about polarization. So you apply a force, and all the particles can do is move a little bit. Right, they develop what you think of as a polarization in solid state. So in solid state, it's talked about that way. If electrons are localized, you know, they can separate off a little bit. They'll respond to the force, right? But on some small length scale. Let's say the localization length's like a lattice spacing, all right? Then what they'll do is they'll move a little bit, and you turn the force off, they'll come back. Right,
but
and
you
can't
give
be
you
really
some kind of oscillating motion with like the momenta in there. I can see that there's no force.
Yeah,
in space,
but the thing is the force we apply slowly enough such that that will be adiabatic.
So okay. You're saying it's gently pushing and then gently stopping to push?
Gently, yeah, on some very specific time scale, which the two of us could discuss.
Okay.
So the idea is in the limit where you would just develop polarization in a solid state sense, yeah. It's slow enough so they kind of move a little bit and move back. Right, but if you have delocalized waves, then it's set up so that those will respond. Yeah, okay.
We have
thank
several
you.
Other questions. So
let's okay, go. Sorry. These discussions are always fun, so it's hard.
Well,
yes.
The question that I asked the previous speaker also, can you see subdiffusion in various dimensions, and how will you see it?
Yeah, so the question about looking for, so the question is, would you see subdiffusion in various dimensions, and how would you see it? That's kind of the point of this measurement. So this is one of the reasons we're doing this thing where we're poking a hole in the gas and watching that hole close, right? Because that, you know, the simplest way of interpreting it, it will close at some diffusion rate. And so we should, I don't know how many, you know, this is why we make a big hole. I don't know how many decades of time and size we can get, but the idea is to try to look at diffusion here and see if we see subdiffusion or diffusion or nothing.
So that's something for the future?
Yeah, you know, we're doing these measurements now, and then maybe a year we'll tell you what's going on.
Did you check for linearity of the response?
The response is definitely not linear. When there is response, it's not linear.
I see. So that's very different from when you do transport measurements. You try to check to be on a linear machine before.
Yeah, and that's why we don't try to interpret what we see when everything can move, right? All we know is there is motion.
Scales the response, scales then like the...
It's not super non-linear.
It's not optical. You put an